Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you for the organizer for the opportunity to speak here. So, well, okay, so I repeat thanks to the organizers for the opportunity to speak here. So what I will be talking about, well, more or less, this is the official topic, and actually it's also about pseudo-random spaces operators, but actually I'm exaggerating somewhat, because about half of the talk will be still about random matrices and related objects. Oh, push it here. Okay, yes. Yeah. Okay, so as was pointed out, no talk here will go without mention of the Dvoretsky theorem and things like Cushion decomposition, the lambda p sets, Gluskin spaces. Well, you also mentioned free probability. I will discuss mostly in the random context still, just sort of like going quickly through, mostly for the possible benefit of non-specialists. The only one problem in which the pseudo-random method is somewhat successful is some problem in approximation of operators or of matrices, and there I will mention random and non-random solutions, pseudo-random solutions, and sketch the proof of the pseudo-random solution. And then I will comment about what we can possibly try to do in the asymptotic geometric analysis. Well, this last quotation is known; it has been used several times. But it hasn't been really attributed. So probably most people know too. There are enough Russians here who know. This is 1906. Spodziewać. Oh, it's a certain Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov. Okay. Okay, so there's some. Okay, so, well, as I promised, Dvoretsky theorem. So one way to state Dvoretsky theorem is as follows. So we have a large norm space, which is reasonably represented as on Rn or Cn. Reasonably just, well, means somehow not in a wild manner, particularly wild manner, and, for example, using the John or Lowner ellipsoid. So then the statement is the following. Well, not the statement. The setup is the following. You consider a random Gaussian matrix, for example, with the independent, identically distributed N of 0, 1 entries, which is tall. So this will represent an embedding into a larger space. And the theorem is that the large space is efficiently large with respect to the smaller space, then this mapping is an almost a multiple of isometry. I think I should maybe there was this device for pointing, which I don't see. Well, okay, I will point here then, whatever. Okay, so is this visible or not? Not probably not best. Well, so in any case, well, more specifically, well, more precisely, if for epsilon is fixed, then there is a function depending only on the dimension of the smaller space and epsilon, so that if the dimension of the space is bigger than that function, then up to certain normalization constant, this map is almost an isometry in this sense. And is means with probability close to 1 with respect to the underlying probability, of course. Well, of course, so this is not a surprise. Then another result, which has been already mentioned here, is the Cushion decomposition. And here we consider the following random matrix. Well, it's one of the possibilities, actually, but this is how it was in the Cushion paper, and also it's interesting because it is introduces the so-called global version of a statement. So we have a map which this time has, it's a 2k by k map, which this time has identity in the upper block and a random unitary matrix or orthogonal matrix in the lower block. Then, again, with large probability, we have, and with some universal constant independent of dimension, and with proper normalization, this map realizes not an almost isometry, but a near isometry, or a good isomorphic embedding into L1 of L2 into L1. So here, so this is why is it decomposition. If you call U1 the graph of G of U in the 2K dimensional space, then what is written here is that this space U1 is C1 Euclidean. Just because, well, okay, this is G is has x on the first coordinate and ux on the second k coordinates. Similarly, whenever we take this space, which is the graph of the subspace, which is the graph of minus u, for exactly the same reasons, we get a new Euclidean subspace. And so, well, this is the argument, whatever, trivial argument. And those two subspaces form an orthogonal decomposition of L2 2K, L2 2K, orthogonal decomposition of L2 2K, which when each of the subspaces, when considered as a subspace of L1, is near Euclidean. So that's Cushion decomposition, and in a way, this is for me sort of like a test case, because we have here this random unitary matrix, and well, the game here will be try to find an explicit matrix which realizes this embedding. And I will comment on this test case a little bit more from other points of view also. So now, lambda p sets. So first, a definition which I state slightly differently. So basically, well, okay, so what we are talking about are subspaces of say, LP, where the up to a normalization constant, and this normalization constant comes only because the measure on the discrete 2K element space is not normalized. If we normalize it, then this normalization constant will essentially disappear. So whenever we work with there is no need to have normalization constants when we have a probability measure which I am assuming here. And we say that a subspace is a lambda p space if for some r strictly smaller than p, the peace and earth norm are equivalent. And then, of course, all norms smaller than P are equivalent to P by Calder inequality. And there is, of course, a quantitative version. Well, this is and this is equivalent to there exists R, and there is a quantitative version which makes sense also for finite dimensional spaces when we keep track of R's and CR's and so forth. So Cushing decomposition says that you can represent the 2K dimensional space as a direct sum of two lambda 2 spaces. And actually, this is somewhat surprising. There is also infinite dimensional variant for the infinite dimensional space, L2-1, say, on 0-1, which can be derived in a reasonably formal way from. And I forgot whose result that was. I don't think it's Cushing's.
That's trivial concept.
Yeah.
Trivial is very complicated.
Okay, yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so so again, the problem here is what we want to find is want to find explicit matrices G or U or subspaces E which work on the previous slides. And what does it mean explicit? It's not absolutely clear. So what we want, well, either a formula or some efficient algorithm. Because of course one can always give an algorithm, right? Just try until you get the right one. Or so there must be some kind of a restriction here. So in particular for this problem, which is the important part of the inequality. Now, maybe just a few technical comments about how we may hope to achieve this type of a situation. So, with this normalization, L1 and L2 norm of X are more or less equivalent unless the effective support of X is small. If the mass of X is distributed somehow reasonably evenly on a reasonable proportion of the coordinates, then the two coordinates are the same. If this is just saying that when you have entries 1, coordinates 1, then L1 norm is square root of N times or square root of K times the L2 norm. And so what we need is a rotation such that U and U of X cannot simultaneously have small supports. So now if we state it this way, this we think immediately of Fourier analysis, because, well, we know that this is the property of the Fourier transform. And so we may look at the discrete variant, discrete Fourier transform. Well, so this is Fourier transform on the group ZK, if you will. And however, it doesn't quite work, because what happens is that it breaks down when the size of the support, both for the function and for the its Fourier transform, are around square root of the dimension. And this is actually totally obvious for the Walsh matrix, which corresponds to the power of the binary of the group of Z2. And because then you can just have exactly you get characteristic function of the first 2 to the S, where S is half K over M over 2 characters, is a characteristic function of similar nature. So what this results in the constant, which is just fourth root of the dimension. So not universal as you would like. So then, well, this leads to next questions. Well, if we think of those lambda p sets, well, first the definition, which is very well everybody heard probably. So we have it's a set of characters, a lambda p set, or it's actually absolutely not necessary that those are characters, just maybe orthogonal system, but it's in the context of characters when it appeared. And then the question is, one may ask is this: is there a group, finite group, say, so that we can make this finite matrix, and a set of characters on that group, which is around half or a proportion of the size of that group, because size of that group limits the dimension in which, well, defines the dimension on which we are working, and so that set is uniformly lambda 2, that is L1 norm and L2 norm are equivalent. And then the answer is, unfortunately, no. And, well, however, there are subsets which satisfy the condition that the cardinality is bigger than a power of k, n is smaller than 1. However, and this is the first part, is I think due to Mikheyev, but it may have been already a hint basically why that's impossible. That would be sort of obvious for combinatorists, because whenever we have, let's say for, in this case, ZK, so if we have a set with positive density, then it contains large arithmetic progressions. And there you can just calculate that this cannot happen, because you can just calculate on the Dirichlet kernel, the L1 norm and the L2 norm do not coincide. It just follows. Immediately, this is Mikheyev's solution was more general and much simpler, and Bourguignon's solution, of course, comes from the construction of the lambda of the precise lambda p sets in LP bigger than 2. So here, theta is 2 over p. Whenever you take a set which is lambda p set with p, which is defined by so that theta equals 2 over p, then we get a lambda, it's also a lambda 2 set with the same cardinality. So, however, Bourguignon's solutions was non-constructive, and the best that there is for theta equals 1/2, and that was already appeared in the paper of Rudin. So there are explicit lambda 4 sets whose construction is based on different sets and finite geometries. So that's the best one can get. That's the farthest, the best, the biggest subspace of L1 on which the L1 and L2 norm coincide that we know is square root of the dimension. And we know that there are subspaces actually of arbitrary proportion. And so the gap between the constructive and probabilistic arguments here is huge. Okay, so almost last topic in those in this review of random things is Gluskin spaces. So how are those obtained? So there were some talks already about that. So one way to obtain a Gluskin space is the following. This time it's a quotient map, so the matrix has to be flat. So basically what one does is one takes just the transposes of the previous maps. So, Gluskin's construction was a variant of variant of this one, except that the columns were not Gaussian, but uniformly distributed on the sphere. But this is, for all practical purposes, the same. I mean, it's those equivalent models, and, well, it's just a question which is easier to calculate with. And this one is somewhat harder to work with, but this corresponds to the Cartesian embedding, and so actually all of those are equivalent in a way. So those spaces, the meta theorem is that those spaces have many extremal properties, and there is no explicit construction in sight, even remotely. Okay, now the very last topic from the review is free probability. So we have random matrices in free probability, whatever is free probability is. So basically, what the theorem is that whenever we take two independent copies of the Gaussian matrix properly normalized, let's say with independent entries, even though the most basic concept there is the basic case there is self-adjoint case. So those are with n of 0, 1 entries, and then we normalize by 1 over square root of size so that the columns have norm approximately 1, and then we can pass to infinity. And then what happens is that in the limit, this pair of two large matrices is asymptotically star-free, whatever that means. So this means those, if you look at the algebraic properties of those two matrices at the same time with respect to the normalized trace, then they behave as if they were free shifts on a free group, independent shifts on a free group with respect to the measure at the origin, at the unit. So now in this case there are explicit examples, but which are obtained by looking at Clifford matrices, but they are not really satisfactory for a number of reasons. Okay, so that's those are the contexts in which we would like to have explicit objects.
After the limit, you have some object that models.
Yes. So there are some. Yeah, there are limiting objects. So there are limiting objects which are the actual, which are really free, limiting algebras which are really free, or subalgebras of an algebra which are really free, and this is which are obtained in the limit by passing to infinity. And so here actually the limiting objects exist, and one can work can be worked with, which makes it nicer. Okay, so the question which I will talk a little bit at length, and in which we have some measure of success in obtaining pseudorandom solutions, is connected with the following question. So first, a definition. So a matrix is reducible. For the purpose of this talk, will be called reducible if it can be written in some orthonormal basis in this block form. So this is not, sometimes one uses reducible for reducible in some basis, not necessarily orthonormal. But from the point of view of approximation, this doesn't make much sense, because almost every matrix is reducible. Right? If you have distinct eigenvalues, necessarily, the matrix is necessarily reducible in that sense. So those are dense. So there is no approximation problem. So, excuse me? Excuse me?
A is not necessarily symmetric.
Right. Yeah. Otherwise, we are in a good shape. This is equivalent to the existence of non-trivial orthogonal projections which commutes with that matrix. So this is our A. In some basis, whatever. And actually, this is a remark which can be easily checked, that in fact the distance to reducible matrices, to the set of reducible matrices for any matrix, in any reasonable norm, is actually equal to infimum of the norm of that commutator. We will think mostly about the operator norm on L2. But this is actually true for any reasonable norm. So the following question was asked. Namely, well, of course, not every matrix is reducible, and somehow the one example is the unilateral shift is not reducible. But maybe one can approximate matrices by reducible matrices, and as dimension goes to infinity, better and better. Now, this seems slightly suspicious that could be the case. However, the situation was, of course, it would be in some sense it would be. I think I am losing track of the used and unused. Slides. Okay, I think here. Okay. Why should we ask that question? First of all, it's sort of, if the answer was positive, it seems that it's a potentially useful result. And it could even be useful from computational point of view, because if we can do such a thing, then we can iterate. And actually we can approximate reasonably well conceivably that would be useful. But the immediate motivation actually was that positive answers would have many nice consequences in operator theory, in quasi-diagonal algebras and things like that, about some structure theorems for Calkin algebra and so forth and so forth. Okay? So, and moreover, for all, this was like in mid-80s, for all classes of matrices that people in operator theory could think of, the answer was positive. So like weighted shifts, tridiagonal matrices, name it. In some cases it was trivial, in some cases it required some work, but the answer was yes, generally. Generally, whenever one could calculate. However, the theorem is that the answer is no, and that that was produced in a paper, joint paper with the late Domingo Herrero. And here is how the example looks like. Okay, so what we consider? Well, we consider for simplicity here only matrices whose size is a multiple of 4, and it's to take care of the general case, it's just slightly. A slight complication more. And we consider the following block matrices. So each letter here, each symbol here represents a block of size m by m. And most of them are zero. Now, this string of identities represents a backward shift. So if we backward shift on blocks, and then we have two appropriately chosen unitaries. Actually, whether it's two or more, whether you have to take or 6 or 10, that's sort of a technical question, but let's think of 4 here. Size 4 by 4 blocks. Okay, so now in the proof of Domingo Herrero, those orthogonal matrices were chosen in the random way, two independently and randomly chosen, in some appropriate sense, randomly. Okay, and here very recently, it's from about 2 years ago. Jerome Benveniste and myself produced an explicit example, and the example has the same structure, but those two matrices are explicit. Now, there is no cross here, but the well, Jerome Benveniste moved to Wall Street some 2 months ago, so well. So well, so from the point of view of mathematics, it may be equivalent. Okay, so how? Okay, so for this, I'm going to give some elements of the proof. So well, there is no statement on this slide here. Statement is only what the statement. Well, okay, I'm going to remove the statement here. So maybe I should instead I should keep somehow those two somehow. Well, no. Like this? Not good? No, I know it's upside down, yes. Okay, what I basically want to keep in mind is both this picture and so that we still remember what we're talking about. Right? Well, anyway. Yeah, this is... No, for some people, for some strange reason, some people cannot read upside down, find difficulty in reading upside down. But this is okay. So what do we know? Okay, so I'm going to write it. Well, have it here. So what we have is we need to show really that for that matrix which is written there. Okay, so we have a statement. We need to show that there is some universal constant, so that the norm of this commutator is bigger than that constant, positive constant, so that it's bigger than that positive constant. And actually, in the paper with Herrero, that constant delta was something like 10 to minus 7. No, those are just orthogonal projections. Non-trivial orthogonal projections. A is a specific matrix, which is there, more or less specific. And P is an arbitrary projection, so you must have this for any projection. Okay? So now I'm going to spend a few minutes, well, hopefully not too much, on somehow analyzing what's happening here. So first of all, let's look at when this thing is zero. Okay, so one way to look at it is just you write your projection as a block matrix, and then you do the calculations. And actually, this is how the proof is actually done, really. But if you wave hands, you can do it slightly faster. So first, look just at this shift part. So when does a projection or any self-adjoint operator matrix commute with the shift? Well, since it's self-adjoint, it has to commute also with the joint of the shift. And what are the operators which commute with both shift and with the joint? Now, this is essentially a scalar program, and we are looking for a 4x4 matrices, or well, whatever, 10x10, which commute with the shift and it's a joint. And those are only multiple of identities. Just well. This is, well, that's, I think, fairly well known. And it can also be computed by hand. Well, this commutant is actually, commutant of S is well known. So, for this to be, so okay, so basically what we have is we have multiple of the identity. If you do the calculation with blocks, what we get is we get a matrix which has identical blocks on the diagonal. Now, here I sort of disregarded those unitary elements which appear there, but actually they do not interfere in the argument. So now, for such an element which has, this is, if you have, those are now k by k matrices, you have those identical matrices on the diagonal and zeros elsewhere. Now, this is, for this to be a projection, each of the x's has to be a projection, because this is just, well, just look at the spectrum, whatever. And actually, in this argument, U1 and U2 do not interfere, and you will get, in addition, Now, all the time I'm talking about the equality, the strict equality. In addition, we get the condition that the unitaries must commute with that projection. This is in order to have exact equality. And this is very easy to see, because if you multiply on the left and on the right, this matrix with something which has Qs on the diagonal, then if you multiply on the right, you multiply everything here by Q on the right. So you get Q, 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 U1, Q, U2, Q. If you multiply on the left, you get everything on the left. Those things cancel out, and you get two commutators which have to be zero. Okay? Now, so this was for to get equality. And maybe first I will write this condition. This just means this can be written as trivially, just by applying U star in the proper site, if you conjugate Q by each of the UIs, UJs, you get the same thing. Okay, so this was for equality, but actually there is a quantitative version of this. And what you can show, and this is by playing on blocks, as I indicated, just doing calculations, for example, doing calculations with blocks, you get the following statement, that if you have a projection which almost commutes, nearly commutes with A, then actually that projection must be close to a projection obtained from four smaller projections, which is somehow not that, which is not used later, but what is used is that there exists a projection on the smaller space which simultaneously commutes with all UJs. Okay, so this is sort of bootstrap something. At the beginning, we just wanted our projection to commute with one matrix, but now we sort of found a trick to get essentially any finite number at the time. Okay, and again, this is equal to that quantity. So here enters property T. Well, anybody probably who knows property T already noticed that somehow this looks suspiciously close, possibly. Okay, so this is just a slight formulation. So what is property T? So this is the definition which I'm going to use. So one says that a group has property T if there is a positive epsilon and a finite subset of that group for which a posteriori one can take any set of generators, so that for any unitary representation of that group which does not have a fixed vector, actually there is this uniform estimate. It's enough to check that every vector is not fixed by one of the images of the generators, and with uniform bound, which is most important, independent of the representation. Okay, so now there is a very quick connection between this definition and what we have here, namely, let's call UJs to be, let's take any irreducible representation, and let's take UJ to be the pi of GJ, where those are generators. And now we consider the joint representation, that is something which assigns to a matrix conjugation by pi of something. So there is another argument G, which is implicit. Okay, so now this is the representation for which we are going to look for fixed points. Okay, so now what this condition here says is that Q needs to be a fixed point for each of those with respect to the adjoint representation to pi. And so this is the connection, right? It's the rest is basically just checking that everything fits, really. So here we have a rho of g of x is substituted by pi of g x pi of g star, which is exactly this expression there. Okay, so now we just observe that. 3 minutes. Yeah. Now we just observe that if pi is reducible, then this is more or less equivalent to the commutant of pi being just multiples of identity. And the same formulas I indicated earlier. Those are exactly fixed points of the adjoint representation. So when we restrict our attentions to matrices with trace zero, there are no fixed points. Okay? And so on those matrices with trace zero, we have a uniform lower estimate of this nature, which means that uj star minus x is greater or equal than norm of x times epsilon. Excuse me? Do I have g somewhere?
Gamma.
No, gamma is any group with property t. If I have a second, I will mention that. Okay, so basically what you do is apply to the definition of property t to a Q normalized so that the trace is projection of Q on trace zero. Now, if you look at this difference here, then this identity doesn't interfere because it appears in both terms. So whether we calculate this quantity for X or for Q, it's essentially the same. And so we apply property T and we get that this is bigger than, maybe not epsilon, but epsilon over 2. And I recall this other estimate, which this was supposed to be smaller than C delta. So this gives a lower bound on delta, which is delta bigger than epsilon than by 2c. Now, of course, I cheated because in a major way, because actually this was supposed to be a representation of Hilbert space. So this is Hilbert-Schmidt norm. And we need the operator now. But that can be controlled because we are dealing with projections. So things depend nicely. And we control ranks of things. So this can be just a few lines calculation that this can be done. Okay, so this is the argument, really.
Right.
Actually, one way to look is that you only look at Q of rank at most n over 2. And in that case, this projection is non-trivial. Yeah. It's almost the same like Q. Is it? Well. Okay, so here are the comments of what is being used. So, for example, the original group with property T was SL3 of Z. Now, the group SL2 of Z, which is much nicer to work with, has a weaker property tau, which also works here. And we use this set of generators. So actually, it can be done with 2. Okay? And now I have a final. Okay. Final slide will be... Question is... If you use those exact matrices, I haven't really worked hard on showing that this is false, which I think is the case. Does this would be a natural candidate within this ideology? But this is very unlikely to follow just for property T, and the reason is that property T doesn't care about bases in Rn or Cn. If you replace those matrices by conjugates, then it's the same thing. But of course, it's not the same for normal one. However, it was checked? Okay, well, good. However, the reasons for property T are often of arithmetic nature. And if you go into the arguments, who knows? Okay, so I will stop here. Thank you.
In other words, you would like to use proper...
Well, I'm not sure property theory, some applying property theory related. Property theory seems to be too spectral theory, theoretical. So this is. Yes?
Just a comment. It seems that this problem, even with one matrix, the finite analog over a finite field, that's exactly error correcting codes, and then you have explicit. Taking any vector of any humming weight, which would be L1 or L2, and getting it to a vector of which is uniformly distributed, it has its weight is spread out more or less evenly, so it would be always a vector of constant weight. That's exactly an linear error correcting code. So over finite fields, it seems like it. Solve problem. I don't know if there is a connection. What happens? Mm.
You do not get embeddings, I think, on the same dimension of proportional dimension.
Oh yeah, sure you do. Yeah, the factor of two will do it. Sure. Yeah, you can have the identity and another matrix, and you get from L, from K to 2K.
Because there are some examples, I think, with n square, right? I think, which are sort of similar.
Definitely, factor of two.
Okay, we can. Look at that, Keith.
I was going to say, do you really think there are just examples there?
Question? Yeah, go ahead.